You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for September 4th, 2015. This will be a European Society of Cardiology focused podcast. I want to first begin by calling attention to the HeartWire on Medscape journalist team. They did an amazing job at ESC. This includes Steve Stiles and Michael O'Riordan, Deborah Browser, Marlene Busco, and two British journalists from Medscape, Sue Hughes and Lisa Nangolian, joined us in London to cover the meeting. These guys do a really great job. They translate these studies, complicated studies. They get quotes from both sides, and their writing is impeccable. And really, the website right now on theheart.org at Medscape looks great. So first, let me tell you what I'm going to talk about. It's going to be a little longer podcast. First is CT scans for evaluation of chest pain, post-PCI protection, ezetimibe for diabetes, high-sensitivity troponin assay for evaluation of chest pain in the emergency department, resistant hypertension, leadless pacemakers, and the benefits of an afternoon nap. First up is Platform. This was a randomized controlled trial that evaluated the utility of a proprietary offline analysis of CT angiogram data in patients with suspected CAD. So the offline analysis is done at a company called HeartFlow, which funded the study. They take CT scan images and they do a functional flow reserve on any of the disease found. The idea being that such functional and non-invasive data might someday supplant non-invasive testing that we have now, and it also may lower the normal of cardiac catheterizations. That would surely be a good thing. There are two arms of this trial, two arms. First was a non-invasive group of patients that had not yet been decided about cardiac catheterization, and then another group of patients who the investigators decided, yes, they were going to catheterization, they were the invasive group, and they randomized to a control arm with no CT-FFR data, and then the other group got CT-FFR data. In the non-invasive group, the CT-FFR did not reduce the number of casts done. A number of patients with obstructive disease when compared with usual non-invasive tests. But in the invasive arm, the CT-FFR did reduce the number of casts, and those that were done, it sharply reduced the rate of normal cardiac catheterization. In the control arm of the invasive group, patients sent directly to cath without CT-FFR, presumably for very serious symptoms, 73% had no disease. So this was proposed as a very positive trial because of it reduced the number of cardiac catheterizations. So I'm going to be a little skeptical about an offline analysis using proprietary software. It sounds a little bit like a black box. Also, the very high rate of normal casts in patients in the direct invasive group is a problem. It sort of suggests a significant bias here. Then there's the matter of excess radiation if we're going to do cardiac CT and then cardiac catheterization. Also, I wonder about the whole evidence base of ischemia-driven investigations. Next up is Matrix. After PCI, we want to protect patients in that window of worry for a few hours after stent placement. So does a prolonged infusion of bivalirudin for several hours perform better than doing only bivalirudin in the cath lab? This is the question of Matrix. And the answer was that it was a tie, basically. There was no benefit to the longer infusion. This was the third of three questions of Matrix. The first question was radial versus femoral and radial 1. The second question was heparin versus bivalirudin and after PCI, and there was no difference. At the ESC presentation, an interesting discussion came up about a non-randomized comparison of low-dose versus high-dose bivalirudin infusion. So if you're going to use bivalirudin in the infusion route, do you use low-dose or high-dose? It was left up to the discretion of the operator. But in this non-randomized comparison, the high-dose looked better. And the buzz was that, okay, if you're going to use the infusion, use the higher dose. But it's tough to form conclusions from this because non-randomized data really brings up the idea of treatment bias. For instance, did the operators use one dosing for a reason? I'm not an interventionalist, but the bottom line is that it seems like there's a small delta here. I mean, the between strategies, not much difference. Next up is an Improve-It IT sub-analysis. So at the EC meeting, a new analysis of the Improve-It trial suggests as much as a subgroup analysis can suggest that ezetimibe may be of specific benefit to diabetes patients. Remember that Improve-It was a trial of ezetimibe plus simvastatin versus just simvastatin in post-ACS patients. So that's important, post-ACS. The big findings from this sub-analysis was that diabetic patients got significant benefit and non-diabetic patients got no benefit. And the subgroup was quite big. I mean, 4,933 patients is a lot of patients. The relative, we must talk relative versus absolute benefits in the diabetes subset. Adding ezetimibe to simvastatin reduced MI by 4.4% absolute, by 2.7% ischemic stroke, and a composite endpoint decreased by 5%. Now, there was no difference in absolute difference in CV mortality. The trial discussant, Martin Simmons from Erasmus University in Rotterdam, did not think these small benefits were worth the cost of the drugs. He basically made a value statement. And I'm skeptical of making too much of this trial, too. First, it's a subgroup analysis of a trial that was barely positive. And second, I still get stuck on the fact that Improve-It was a straw man comparator. I mean, in the explanation of the benefit, the researchers discussed the fact that ezetimibe lowered LDL levels, and lower LDL levels was probably the reason why diabetic patients improved. But, I mean, heck, we can lower LDL levels with a more potent statin. And then how would have that made ezetimibe look? Well, let's move on to high-sensitivity troponin. Treatment guidelines currently advise using high-sensitivity troponin assays and then waiting 3 hours. But the BACC trial, that's Biomarkers in Acute CV Care trial, presented at ESC, suggests that this might be able to be done in 1 hour. It was a European study. It had to be a European study because in the United States, we don't have the high-sensitivity troponin. The results of this 1,000-patient-strong study were excellent. The test was accurate, and it allowed 41% of patients to be ruled out for myocardial infarction in 1 hour. I mean, think about that. That's a big chunk of patients to be ruled out in 1 hour. This algorithm was validated in two independent cohorts, and I think it could have a great impact in the United States. We already have emergency rooms that are overcrowded. In real life, we don't have 3 hours to wait around for a diagnosis of MI. It's really shocking to me that we don't have this in the United States. Next up is resistant hypertension. This was the Pathway 2 trial. It took an interesting approach to patients with resistant hypertension. First of all, this is a big topic because estimates have up to 10% of patients with high blood pressure being resistant. And we also know that renal denervation doesn't work for resistant hypertension. At least that's the results of Simplicity 3 trial. Pathway 2 studied the benefit of adding to the ACD approach. So the ACD approach is angiotensin ACE-ARB plus calcium channel blocker plus thiazide diuretics. So each patient in Pathway 2 was its own control. First, they took ACD therapy and added spironolactone, then a period with bisoprolol, then a period with the alpha blocker doxazosin. And when it came out, aldosterone antagonist spironolactone won by a bunch. 8 millimeter reduction in blood pressure. The impact here that aldosterone antagonists have already been shown to be beneficial in heart failure. I like these drugs. They're inexpensive. They're pretty well tolerated. They spare potassium. But that said, the blood pressure lowering effect was modest, only 8 millimeters. And the sham control of the renal denervation trials showed a 11 millimeter drop in blood pressure. So we maybe shouldn't get too excited about this, but I do think it helps us think about a potentially useful drug that's inexpensive and well tolerated. Next up is the leadless pacemaker. This is the most exciting trial from ESC, I think. It's also the leading edge of a new chapter in electrophysiology. Vivek Reddy presented the results of the leadless 2 trial. There were 526 patients implanted at 56 different international centers with this St. Jude NanoStim pacemaker. It goes through the groin femoral vein up with a sheath into the RV, and it acts basically as a VVIR pacemaker. The results were pretty good, 96% success rate implanting these things. It's most notable that 99 out of 100 implanters, this was their first case. They had no background in leadless pacemakers. The pacing parameters held up at 6 months. Lead impedance thresholds and sensing thresholds, pacing thresholds looked good. Battery longevity is estimated up to 15 years, but even if it's more than 10 years, that's significant. Now, the adverse events got some attention. The overall complication rate at 6.5% is certainly more than a standard VVI pacemaker. But pericardial effusions in 1.3%, that's not bad for a new technology. I'm sure that as we get better doing these cases and as the technology improves, the sheaths get smaller, that the complication rate will go down. And of course, I urge you to look past the limitations of a first-generation device. I mean, think about leadless. Pacemaker companies are already looking at a leadless pacemaker paired with a subcutaneous ICD. I mean, think about that, a ICD without the problems of the lead. It's a big deal. Finally, I'll close with the benefits of an afternoon nap. One of the most popular studies at ESC was looked at the potential blood pressure lowering effects of a 60-minute post-lunch afternoon nap. And how beautiful was it that this research comes from Greece? And so suspend your cynicism for a moment while I tell you about the short story here. This was an observational study with about 200 patients in each group. These were patients with pretty serious hypertension. They had multiple risk factors. And the researchers reported that those who reported reported taking an afternoon nap of 60 minutes ended up with a 6 millimeter lower blood pressure at the end of the study. Now that may not seem a lot, but of course, any drop in blood pressure has the potential to lower cardiovascular events. And I know it's not earth-shattering news. This was an observational trial. It's soft. Yes, I admit. But it does point to the health effects of always being on the gas. And I say always being on the gas, meaning persistent sympathetic stimulation. And I'm not going to preach. People have choices. They can live their life the way they want. But it seems to me wise as their caregivers, as their health advisors, to at least advise them on the fact that much of the medicine we use these days to treat things like high blood pressure and atrial fibrillation is really unnecessary and maybe just countering the effects of lifestyle. So that's it for this week. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the heart.org on Medscape.